Welcome to Israel Horizons podcast. I am your host, Maya Haber. Today, we spoke with Noam Schuster. Noam is 29. She's the program coordinator of the UN program Interpeace, working with strategic populations in the Israeli society who have previously been excluded from the peace process. She engages former Soviet Jews, Palestinians, ultra-Orthodox women, and Likud Center officials. Her life experience gives her a unique perspective from which to challenge our conventional wisdom about Israeli politics. Noam asks,
how do we talk about a solution, not as a solution and not as separation? How do we talk about reconciliation and not a brutal divorce? I mean, when we look at the different vocabulary that we have now to try and build the capacity for change or for a discourse about possible solutions, we don't even have vocabulary.
Noam argues that the peace process of the 1990s failed because we have been so focused on the final product, on divorcing the Palestinians and establishing a two-state solution, that we failed to engage Israelis in the process. In many ways, Noam is the embodiment of this failure. Even though she was raised in a community that exemplifies the peace camp more than any other, as a young brown Israeli woman, Noam has often been excluded from the camp.
Maybe I looked too Mizrahi, maybe I looked like an outsider, I don't know, but I was forbidden from getting into this demonstration, and it was a very, very tough moment for me. I wanted to find a community and to be with people that I believe shared the same opinions like mine, trying to end this madness of summer of 2014, and I was not allowed entry. And this is, in a nutshell, this story. It happened to me, but it's not about me. Who is allowed to this camp that talks about peace?
I hope you enjoy the program. Noam, let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and how did your experience influence your attitudes towards the peace camp?
I'm 29 years old. I grew up in the only community in Israel where Palestinians and Jews live together by choice. Some of you might know it. It's Neve Shalom in Hebrew, Wahat Salam in Arabic, and the Oasis of Peace in English. My mother was born in Iran and my father is the son of Holocaust survivors from Romania. So in my Jewish heritage also, I'm mixed, Eastern European and Persian background. My mother's Mizrahi identity is very strong given that she was born in Iran. And I have turned out to look beautiful and dark like her. And growing up in a place like Neve Shalom Wahat Salam, which is the home of the traditional peace camp, I, as a young Jewish Israeli who was born into the traditional peace camp, I was mainly surrounded by the traditional peace camp as you know it, which is mainly liberal, mainly secular, mainly Ashkenazi. It didn't take me a while to realize that I don't feel like I belong, and I didn't see many Mizrahis around me. And my mother's extended family was not around us or did not really support us in when we moved to Neve Shalom Wahat Salam. And I started asking myself a lot of questions, being a girl that is growing up with Palestinians, that is growing up to speak fluent Arabic, not for intelligence purposes, but to communicate with my best friends. And when I was opening my mouth to speak in Arabic, people were asking me if I'm Palestinian all the time. Most recent example, when I went to the HaRSQ conference in New York, every 5 minutes, someone would come up to me and say, so, you're Palestinian from where? And I said, no, I'm not Palestinian. I'm Mizrahi, and I speak Arabic because I learned Arabic from a young age in a bilingual school. This type of identity, this doesn't exist. It's a very alternative, I would say, identity. And one of my missions, I think, is to shed light on what kind of a personal alternative we can serve to be in order to exemplify how Israel can look like in the future and what Israelis or different people who believe in a different Israel and a better future for Israel can start thinking about. And the Arabic language, Mizrahi identity, are the first things that come up to my mind because these are the personal examples that I carry with me. Growing up, I was involved with all of the peace building, people to people, traditional dialogue groups, as you can imagine. And I witnessed that converted, exclusive small groups are being convinced and the same people were meeting each other from Ramallah and Tel Aviv, not reaching out to the masses. I was admitted to Brandeis University as a coexistence scholar in 2007. I graduated in 2011, and I was there with a Palestinian scholar from Jaffa as well. And together on campus, we were doing a lot of things that have to do with the conflict, and we were advocating for many, many things together. And as I was about to finish my studies, I moved to Rwanda as well to get a bit of distance from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and to go to another example like Rwanda and to see what kind of things resonate with me and what kind of things I can be learning from a different context in a different place that such as Rwanda that is still healing from such a enormous catastrophe and genocide occurring there in 1994. And I witnessed the power of forgiveness, the power of compromising your will for revenge, your will to transmit some kind of hatred to your children, what you have to compromise in order for your children to have a different future. And as someone who grew up in a community where celebrating Israel's Independence Day and acknowledging the catastrophe of the Palestinians, the Nakba Day, could go hand in hand together, could be acknowledged together in history classes, in the classroom, with your family, with your friends, there was absolute, I discovered a narrative that absolutely doesn't have to haunt each other, but can coexist next to each other. And for me, the key to coexistence is existence. I think once narratives exist and once people exist and once people have the freedom to exist and to express themselves, the next natural step will be coexistence. And for me, the well-being of the Palestinians is the well-being of the Israelis. Those two are intertwined, and I hope that with the dark image that we get all the time from Israeli politics, I do think that it's important to not lose the hope. I have, as a young Israeli, I have to keep up some hope. I have to believe that things will be different. I have to be looking at other contexts, such as Rwanda or South Africa or Northern Ireland, or now a bit of Cyprus we're looking at, to see that impossible can happen and it's a long-term investment. For those of you who are supporting different peace-building programs and peace-building initiatives and are looking at the dying peace camp from afar, there are things that we can do to revive it. There are things that we can do to make it more legitimate. There are things that we can do to make it more inclusive. There are actors that we can be working with that we might not be in 100% full agreement with, but we can see the potential in empowering different narratives from within constituencies that maybe we didn't feel like they are our natural allies. We can for sure work in order to try to generate and to create more positive agendas and narratives coming from different communities in Israel that are considered spoilers or obstacles, instead of letting the right wing be the ultimate ones that are filling this vacuum of exhaustion that Israelis carry with them from the traditional kind of two-state solution. When I came back from Rwanda in 2012, I joined the international peace-building organization called Interpeace, which was founded by the UN in 1994. I joined in 2012. And in the beginning, when I heard the rationale behind the work, I was very confused. I didn't think that it's possible. It was expressed to me that the program aims to work with populations traditionally excluded from the peace process, like the Russian-speaking population, the religious nationalist population, the ultra-Orthodox population. And I looked at people around me and I said, what? These people want to talk about peace? How come? But very, very quickly, I realized that this is where we should invest our energy. It's very easy for us to create a like-minded environment and to sit with people who are already converted and who already agree with us. The hard task for Israelis right now, in my opinion, and I think that many Palestinians will agree with me as the same strategy for the Palestinian society, is actually not to confront the Palestinian side, is actually to confront our own society and to look internally inside Israel on the brothers and sisters that we've missed along the way as we were talking about a secular Ashkenazi peace. And I think it's time for us to look inwards. And I think that a greater internal social cohesion within different parts of Israeli society might be our only and last resort to try and find a more sustainable examples for peace with the Palestinians that will actually speak to a larger group of Israelis, and hopefully also the same process from the Palestinian side that could speak to a larger amount of Palestinians. I will just say that before going into Interpeace and this process, which I will be happy to, you know, explain to you a bit more on how we work and who we work with, I had several interviews with human rights and peace organizations that I'm sure you're all aware of. And I experienced some hard issues, and I think that it's important for me to be speaking about it because I see myself as a part. I'm a part of the community. I'm a young woman who grew up the Salam Neve Shalom. And the peace industry, if we may call it that way, it's to a large extent my home. And when I was sending my CV all around to different organizations, the type of issues I encountered are not easy, not simple. It was a big, big slap in my face. My CV says Noam Schuster, which is can be considered as a male Ashkenazi name. Noam, as you know, is a unisex name. So people who get my CV and didn't see my face before might have thought that this is an Ashkenazi man. And I was called into interviews. One interview in particular where the interviewee who came to accept me didn't think that I was the Noam Schuster she was waiting for. And I came in to shake her hand and saying, no, you're next in line. I'm interviewing. I'm waiting for Noam Schuster. And then I said, I'm Noam Schuster. And there was a lot of embarrassment. Within 5 minutes into this interview, a lot of racially controversial comments were being made about me not looking like I'm fit enough to be working on high policy papers, but maybe more in the field work because I look like someone who could really be, good in the field and not working on policy papers. And different examples that I can give you and that really prove to me what it's like to be a Mizrahi, you know, a grown-up with a degree who's looking for a job in our peace industry that apparently has a lot to learn and a lot to change. And I think my kind of process and me kind of getting into Interpeace and doing this kind of work and suddenly finding myself doing programs eventually with Shas, with ultra-Orthodox rabbis, with religious Zionist stakeholders, with Russian-speaking population, with Mizrahi right-wing actors from the Likud. You know, you have these aha moments where you're like, okay, things should happen in a certain way, and apparently my identity and the complexity of my identity and my ability to be in many camps at once in different Israeli rooms and to be able to coordinate and to facilitate in between a very contradicting world, this is probably where I should have been. But I think that it's important that I share some of the messages, and I think that it's important that we realize that there are a lot of changes taking place. I mean, a lot of frustrations, but also a lot of changes taking place. There is a new emerging young generation of leaders, I think, within the peace camp who are really taking a lead on changing some of the major organizations. We have new directors in many of the major organizations that you know, and I think they bring in new thinking. They bring in some truthful self-criticism from the past and willingness to change and to learn for the future. And most importantly, risk takers trying to do things in a non-conventional way. And I'm happy to be engaging with some of these young leaders more and more recently, and also to be checking more options with religious and community leaders on how we could be empowering religious leaders and religious narratives that could potentially support peace deals and support non-violent agreements and actually highlight that the occupation contradicts Jewish values, and the Jewish values are not values that are against peace. And I think that traditionally we have mastered how to exclude religion from the peace discourse, and now it's time for us to deconstruct what peace means for Israel and reconstruct it together without excluding those that were previously excluded. And really having a truthful discussion about how the occupation doesn't just destroy the Palestinians, but it destroys our moral fabric, and it ends up in our home in the end. And as Israelis who of course care about the future of everyone on this land, but most importantly to talk about occupation in a way where we want to save our own society as well.
How would you describe the current discourse about peace in Israel? What happened in recent years?
To most Israelis, there is no occupation. To most Israelis, there is no conflict. To most Israelis, right now, there isn't anything urgent to move from our seat and even discuss the conflict. You've seen in 2011 with the social movement protests that no one dared to bring up the political side of things. And if they did, they were, you know, out the window. Any political leader today knows, whether it's Yair Lapid, whether it's Bibi, whether it's anyone getting into Israeli politics and carrying some kind of a legitimate discourse, not to mention the word peace, not to mention the word occupation. So just trying to formulate a discussion on our vision for the future is something extraordinary. For me, the fact that Israelis are even convening to discuss obstacles for peace, for me, Israelis convening to even acknowledge that there's a political situation here, is a huge step. And now, ironically, when we're watching this kind of debate on TV, on where there are shows or politicians that are brought in to discuss this, a funny thing happens. We would have on TV a very traditional centrist left, maybe a labor Tel Aviv secular person who talks about the importance of separating from the Palestinians, the importance of brutal divorce from the Palestinians to maintain the Jewish and democratic character of Israel. And next to it, suddenly, there is a member, a very legitimate and a very powerful member of the current coalition, a right-wing religious Zionist member of Knesset called Yehuda Glick. This is just one example, saying, but we want equality. We can continue having Jewish democratic state and give the Palestinians equality. And so I'm not trying to impose or empower the two-state solution. I'm not trying to kill the two-state solution. I think that it's still something that could potentially happen. I'm also not trying to empower, you know, a superior Jewish all, you know, one state that gives Palestinians full rights but maintains, of course, a Jewish superior. I'm not trying to say this one is right, this one is right, but what we are witnessing right now is the collapse of what we used to call a left-wing Israel and a right-wing Israel. What we are seeing actually is that those that think that they perceive themselves or are being perceived or historically being perceived as the Mapai, as the Labor, as the secular Zionist, they're actually proposing something that might be more militaristic, that might be more militant or might be more, look like a more right-wing agenda than what the right-wing is trying to propose. Now, in between these two, in my eyes, failing proposition, one describing a brutal divorce from the Palestinians, who are we kidding? How can we make 22% of the population inside Israel divorce their cousins behind the wall? Really? Is this really going to happen one day? No. And on the other hand, am I going to empower an ultra-national religious activist who want a superior Jewish state and giving Palestinians a favor by giving them an Israeli ID card that I'm not sure that they even want it. Where am I in between these two failing agendas? There's a vacuum in the middle. There's a dangerous vacuum in the middle. And today, those that are fifth vacuum are dangerous politicians from the right, because the left wing is staying at its place. The left wing continues to talk about the blueprint of the two-state solution, thinking that one day the Israelis are going to wake up and discover the two-state solution as if we haven't been talking about it since 1967. It's not going to happen. There is a big chunk of leaders, of activists, of people from unexpected communities who I think want to step into this vacuum, and we have to empower them to step into this vacuum and start talking some sense, meaning that, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, the Rainbow Coalition in South Africa, how a political process, on the one hand, is backed by an important religious authority. A political process in Israel cannot be successful without serious spiritual backing. Who are our strong spiritual leaders that we can start building alliances with in order to potentially, in the future, support a peaceful solution? Who are they? Rabbi Ovadia Yosef in 1979 gave a religious ruling when he was the chief rabbi of Israel, saying that the value of life is higher than the value of land. This gave a spiritual backing to the peace agreement with Egypt. It gave the religious backing for settlers to be evacuated from Sinai. Where are we as people who are looking at the messages in these eyes? Who are we really engaging? Who are we looking in the faces? Where can we find those peaceful agendas of religious leaders who want to deconstruct the word peace and reconstruct the word peace? And I'm saying it again, and they do exist. saying that they don't exist and viewing settlers as the enemies and viewing everyone religious as the enemies is betraying the future of Israel. I can walk out and I can walk away from the Israeli society tomorrow, and I can be speaking to, you know, people in the UN in Geneva all day and really have a very respectful audience abroad. But am I really looking to my community in the eye? And, you know, and for many of us, and I think many of us also who are working on these issues who are Mizrahi, we have family members that are the people that we have to deal with. Maybe you also, many of you also who are involved in different initiatives, you also face a more conservative set of minds in your own family. And I know many Jewish Americans who are doing wonderful things who on a daily basis have to confront their families. In my family, it's a bit of an extreme example because I don't know if you know, there is a famous kind of a newly added member of the Likud, the famous rapper called The Shadow. He has 250,000 followers on Facebook, and every post that he posts makes a lot of noise, and he's like this provocative fashion. He's the cousin of my mother, and he's kind of, in 2014, during the summer, the war in Gaza, he was kind of the face of the fascist right-wing mobilizing activists to haunt leftists in the street and beat them down. And I remember feeling very devastated and frustrated in the summer of 2014 as he was doing all of this and knowing that a member in my extended family is doing all of this. And I decided that I'm going to an anti-war rally in Tel Aviv, which had maybe 5 to 7 people. No, I'm joking. I mean, it had a small amount of people going, and mainly there were a lot of people paranoid and fearful, rightfully fearful, left-wing activists fearing that they're going to be punched and beaten down by right-wing activists, including my mother's cousin. In the left-wing, in the anti-war rally, they were spontaneous selectors that were kind of watching out for right-wing activists trying to come into the demonstration and haunt leftists. And I came to that rally, and maybe I looked too Mizrahi, maybe I looked like an outsider, I don't know, but I was forbidden from getting into this demonstration. And it was a very, very tough moment for me, because across the street, my fascist member of family that I just described to you was there holding signs that are disgusting signs. And I wanted to find a community and to be with people that I believe shared the same opinions like mine, trying to end this madness of summer of 2014. And I was not allowed entry. And this is, in a nutshell, this story. It happened to me, but it's not about me. It's who is allowed to this camp that talks about peace? Who is allowed to hold the word peace and start saying what it means? Maybe we have to do so much soul searching in the way this camp has been exclusive and has forbidden entry, like in my case, you know, in some cases, for people to join.
It sounds to me like you're criticizing our tendency to focus on solutions while ignoring the process. When we focus on solutions, we miss the process. We fail engaging people who could support us. So tell us about the process. Who do you engage? How do you engage those who have not been traditionally part of the peace camp?
It's very difficult. It takes time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of compromise. I remember trying to kind of translate your question into, you know, maybe a concrete story. 2 years ago, I stepped into one of the offices, the major Likud centers in Rosh Ha'ain, which is Mizrahi, traditional kind of Yemenite right-wing voters. And the director of this Likud cell told me, "What brings you here? The people who have entered this door were only people from right-wing or pro-settler organizations that wanted to take the young leaders from this town on tours to settlements, to settle in their hearts even more." And I think that this story touches upon, you know, many conversations that I have. How do we know that there aren't people out there who are our partners? Have we tried? Have the peace camp or the resources that have been allocated to so many programs throughout the years, did anyone ensure or secure that they are being targeted to in a diverse and that there is a dialogue happening on an inclusive manner between the different parts of society? So when I'm talking about, okay, we want to look at the final solution and we're really keen on knowing, you know, so what's the future of the West Bank and what's going to happen, one state solution, two state solution, and we're missing the key word that is a process. when we start building alliances between the different marginalized groups within Israeli society, things come up to the table naturally. And different agendas and different dynamics and different interests in between groups inside the Israeli society start emerging to the table, and it makes the discourse completely, completely different. You know, the religious Zionists now have mainstreamed into the consciousness of the mind of Israeli people, and think into politics, into the army. If the army elite previously were the social kibbutz, you know, elite, you know, secular Zionism, now this elite is slowly being replaced by the Zionist elite. And so, you know, and you know that things that they didn't think about before when they were marginalized, now that they're emerging ruling power, ultimately they're going to think about things differently. They will have to provide solutions. They will have to provide strategic solutions to Israel. Is going to become more isolated as we continue building in settlements. There is going to be different circumstances. So why am I saying a process? Because it's not going to happen tomorrow that we're going to find the kind of peaceful voices that are coming, or the potential alternative peace camp that is going to emerge from these communities. It's a process, but we have to start from now. We have to start from now because we've learned too much about our historical mistakes in the peace camp. And we have to start from now because we're looking reality in the eyes, that the Israeli society is going somewhere, and we should be listening to these winds, and we should be trying to empower those that are still in a strategic position to talk about peace, and also to have a significant amount of followers, and to not be considered as illegitimate. I can tell you from the personal experiences that I've been having in the program that there is a young, emerging Russian-speaking generation that is looking way beyond Lieberman, member of Knesset Ksenia Svetlova, who is in the Zionist Union, who has managed to really expose and show how the Russian voices are not just in one place and not just for Lieberman. The ultra-Orthodox community also is taking a larger step into an integration in Israeli society, into politics, into a more empowered role of women participating in the different society roles. We have Palestinian citizens of Israel who are gradually coming into a realization about their national identity being Palestinian, and them accepting that on an identity level they are Israeli to some extent. There is a lot of dynamics that are happening, and a lot of work internally to do with all the communities. I think the recent recognitions and acknowledgments that the Mizrahis are receiving from the historical injustices of Mizrahi community within the Ashkenazi establishment, and the different changes in organizations and young activists, and the cultural kind of revolution and Mizrahi young revolution that is happening. All of these elements are ultimately going somewhere, emerging somewhere. And so I think that we need to have our kind of listen to that call. I hope that I could be contributing to not looking at someone who is settler or pro-settler or religious Zionist and immediately considering them as my enemy, but rather understanding that he or she might be key actor to engage with actors that have not been my partner so far. All of this have to be taken into consideration.
So when you do that, aren't you confronting the Israeli mainstream discourse that sees Palestinians as a demographic threat?
Let me tell you, for example, I was just in a conversation from a brilliant researcher from the Van Leer Institution, and we were talking about a poll done here in Israel, asking Israelis, do you support equality between Jews and Arabs? The answer was yes. And then the follow-up to that was, do you support that Palestinians will have a say in future politics, in future major decisions, coalition, blah, 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 you know, what it takes to be equal? And the answer was no. And so does everyone want peace? Of course everyone wants peace. Everyone believes in democracy? Of course everyone believes in democracy. But what happens when we dive in to what it actually means? And I think this is one of the most difficult discussions to have with Israelis today. How do we make Israelis see the Palestinians as something much, much more complex than a demographic threat? How do we talk about a solution, not as a solution and not as separation? How do we talk about reconciliation and not a brutal divorce? I mean, when we look at the different vocabulary that we have now to try and build the capacity for change or for a discourse about possible solutions, we don't even have vocabulary. Even bougie, even the Labor Party, even the left wing dropped constructive, humanizing vocabulary that we can talk about. So it's difficult. It's difficult, but I think that we should be confronting these difficult questions and confronting those that we are trying to engage. So you believe in democracy, so you believe in equality. Get into the details. The Palestinians are here to stay. They are your partners. Are you going to be implementing a superior system that controls over other people? How come, even if we're only talking about the current borders of Israel, how come 22% and a growing percentage of Palestinian citizens of Israel, how can you claim that they're not going to have a stake in the future of Israel? It contradicts, you know, when does, you know, a Jewish only in democratic values, where does it contradict? This discussion is very, very difficult to have. But one of the things that we have to do is to be the ones that facilitate the discussion on how, and to, of course, have Palestinians as well as partners in this discussion to get Israelis out of this image that the Palestinians are a demographic threat. And to be honest with you, this narrative of Palestinians being a demographic threat is what keeps Bibi in his seat. What will he do? How can they justify the amount of unanswered questions they have for us and for our future if the Palestinians are not a demographic threat? There isn't even a motivation among the leadership to support narratives of Palestinians who want to get out of this novel demographic threat. And this is one of our biggest obstacles. You know, someone like Ayman Aude, who is a wonderful politician, he's a genuine human being. I know him in person. I know his intentions. What he believes in is not radical. It's very, very basic. It's nothing radical to believe in equality. It's nothing radical about wanting self-expression. But why? How do we get? How did we get to a phase in Israeli society where what people like him stand for looks like a demographic threat in our eyes? And it's going to be a hard loop to get out of, but not an impossible one.
How can we in the Jewish American community help?
I think that the Jewish American community is the most important community in the diaspora that will help us to shape a better Israel, a better future for Israelis and Palestinians. And I always say, when I speak especially to Jewish American audiences, as a graduate also of Brandeis University, that it's time to stop giving Israel discounts. You see yourself as a huge stakeholder in the future of this land, and there was this notion in the past of, you know, let Israelis and Palestinians solve issues and we should be in the background, the back off. It's not true anymore. You are partners. You should be a part of this. Your taxes are paying for some of the major problems that we have. So I'm happy that you are a part of this conversation.
So I want to ask you one last question. You graduated from Brandeis. When you look at the Jewish American community, what do you see? What is the process you're prescribing for us?
I think that as I mentioned to you, that one of my priorities right now is to realize that my struggle is at home here with my own society. Your own struggle is with your own different, you know, Jewish American, different stakeholders, okay? You are also fragmented. You also have the powers within the Jewish American establishment also is fragmented, and there is also a debate. You have a debate at home regarding Israel as well. Now, I'm not saying that you know, different pressures or different criticism, now you should neglect it. No, but I think that so much of it depends on the internal discussion and the internal alignments that you have within the different Jewish American organizations, communities, different constituencies. One of the things that always amazes me is there's so many new organizations and new struggles and so much fragmentation within the progressive left that instead of unifying on the issues that are important to you, it to me, it feels like every conference I go to in the United States, I just see more and more fragmentation within the already fragmented progressive left in the United States. So I'm thinking to myself, where is the real initiative, you know, to be united on a certain front between you, you know, there is, and again, I know these are heavy issues and I know these are sensitive issues and I know there are some real arguments happening between J Street and Jewish Voice for Peace and the different campaigns and the different, you know, the center left. And I, to be honest, until a larger national, unified kind of awakening, calling emerges from within your own community in regards to the different requests and criticism to Israel, it will be hard to move something. Because, you know, being framed as BDS, whether in the United States or whether in Israel, halas, you're done, you're BDS, you're out the window, okay, let's go. Then you have J Street, and J Street, the different tactic. Okay, so should we just concentrate on settlements? But wait, as an Israeli, I'm telling you, why don't you look in the reality to the face that it's time to maybe engage with different actors within within the religious Zionist community? Maybe it's time to look in the eyes of those who are thinking beyond the two-state solution and look in the eyes of the reality that probably many settlements will not be evacuated. Maybe it's time to look beyond what we know as the blueprint or the usual kind of tactics that I think many of us and you, you know, Jewish American stakeholders have been trying for many, many years. What are the alternatives? What could be, you know, what are the conversations that could be done differently? And, you know, and there is so much of it happening in Israel, whether it's the Mizrahi discourse, whether it's different, you know, settler organizations that are going to the field and working directly with Palestinians on different alternative issues. I don't know, but I think that, you know, I think that really starting to you, getting this strategy to look inward more inside the Jewish American community and have more united front on some issues and maybe a more truthful discourse about Israel and go and convince, you know, important key stakeholders within the Jewish American communities to stop giving blind love to Israel and that real love is it. Do you think that the major stakeholders within the Jewish American community understand that today giving blind love to Israel is actually betraying Israel because because the situation is so bad? Is it a question that has been truthfully addressed in wider circles than just the progressive? Is it? Because referring the question back to Israelis, believe me, we're sweating, we're doing it, we're trying really to find answer, to find alternatives.
You've been listening to a conversation with Noam Shuster, brought to you by Partners for Progressive Israel. I am your host, Maya Haber. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Until next time, shalom.